All right, we're pleased to have the Republican candidate, winner of Tuesday's primary for governor, Eric Greitens. Mr. Greitens is a graduate of Oxford and has tremendous background as a soldier, as a member of SEAL team, served our country overseas in conflicts in Afghanistan, went on to found a nonprofit, and is the author of several books. And Tuesday, as I said, was a pretty decisive victor in the Republican primary. And so please join me in welcoming Eric Greitens to our endorsement session. Mr. Greitens.
How's everyone doing today? Good, outstanding, good. Well, I'm really pleased to be with all of you. As Blake mentioned, I'm a husband and father. My wife, she and I have two little boys. We've got Joshua, who is just now 2 years old, and we've got Jacob, who is 2 months old. And we've been trying to explain to Joshua for a little while that he was about to become a big brother. So, you know, we've been showing him pictures of daddy lions and lion cubs and pictures of mommy giraffes and baby giraffes. But when Jacob showed up, I think he was actually a little disappointed. So I think he was expecting a baby elephant or something like that. But what I thought we could do this morning, I'd be happy just to tell you a little bit about myself, why I'm running, talk a little bit about what we can do together, and then happy to take any questions. Does that sound good? Great. So look, I was born and raised here in Missouri. My mom is now retired, but for over 3 decades of her life, she was an early childhood special education teacher. She worked with kids who had Down syndrome, kids who had Asperger's, kids who had severe disabilities, helping those kids and their families to get a good start in life. My dad worked for the Department of Agriculture. We did not have a lot growing up, but I was very fortunate, had wonderful coaches and teachers, and I got a scholarship to college. Went off to college, got a good education in the classroom. I also got a great education outside of the classroom. And most of that education took place in a boxing gym where I had a fantastic coach. This was a guy named Earl Blair. Earl had served in the military at the end of World War II. He'd grown up in the Depression, and he'd spent a lot of his life kind of raising young men through boxing. I also, before I went to college, I had never been outside of the country before. I'd really never been very far outside of Missouri. But my sophomore year, I had a teacher who asked me if I wanted to go to Bosnia. You'll all remember that in the mid-1990s, there were these vicious campaigns of ethnic cleansing that were happening in Bosnia. I went overseas to work with kids whose parents had been killed during the ethnic cleansing. I really enjoyed doing that work. I found that you could save lives, you could change lives, and so I continued to do that. I worked in Rwanda with kids whose parents had been killed during the genocide. I worked in Cambodia with kids who'd lost limbs to landmines, kids who were survivors of polio. I worked in one of Mother Teresa's homes for the destitute and dying overseas. And let me be clear that all of the work that I was doing was very simple work. I was feeding dying patients. I was working with kids in a kindergarten. But I was also witness to the power of some truly incredible leadership. And I found that when you had strong leaders who were willing to step forward with humility and compassion and courage and ask their fellow citizens to join them, you could do tremendous things, even in situations of extraordinary hardship and poverty and violence and war. Now, at the end of my time studying, I had a decision to make about what I was going to do next, and there were kind of 3 options that were in front of me. There was a business that promised me they'd pay me more money than both of my parents combined had ever made. University offered that I could stay and teach. And then I had this offer from the U.S. Navy. The United States Navy said to me, they said, if you join the Navy, they said, we will pay you $1,332.68 per month. They also said as part of this package deal, they said that the minute that you sign up on the dotted line, you're going to owe us 8 years. They said, in return for that, they said, we'll give you one and only one chance at basic underwater demolition Navy SEAL training. They said, you make it through the training, you'll be on your way to being a Navy SEAL, but it's the hardest military training in the world. Over 80% of the candidates quit. They said, if you quit, you still owe us 8 years, and we're going to tell you where and how you're going to serve. Now, the reality is, it's not actually that great of a recruiting pitch. Right? Well, look, I made a decision to join for a couple reasons, and one of those was that both of my grandfathers had served in World War II. And I believe that we all are all of us inheritors of a tradition, of a legacy, of men and women who have gone before us, who have served and who have sacrificed. And I think that there comes a time in all of our lives when we need to figure out how we're going to carry that legacy on. So I joined the Navy on January 20th, 2001. This was obviously before September 11th. I was in the SEAL team training when September 11th happened. It obviously shaped all of our worlds. For those of us who were in Naval Special Warfare, it meant that we knew that our class was going to war. I ended up doing 4 deployments in the global war on terrorism. I was in Afghanistan in 2003, Southeast Asia in 2004, in the Horn of Africa in 2005, and then I served in Iraq in 2006 and 2007. Now, when I was serving in Iraq, I was serving as a commander of an al-Qaeda targeting cell. As a commander of an al-Qaeda targeting cell, my unit's mission was to capture mid to senior level al-Qaeda leaders in and around the city of Fallujah, Iraq. You'll all remember this was the beginning of the surge, so it was a busy time. And every time the Marines would leave the compound, IED would go off, a sniper would shoot at them, an RPG would be shot at them. So it was a busy time. But we had a great team and a very productive deployment. And look, people will tell you that it's tough serving in the military, and certainly sometimes it was. I will also tell you it was a great honor. It's a great honor to wake up every single day surrounded by a team of people, all of whom had taken an oath to defend our Constitution, and all of whom were willing to give their lives in service to that oath and to each other. Now, on March 28, 2007, we'd been on an operation until about 2 o'clock in the morning. We all went to sleep about 3 o'clock that morning. And about 6 o'clock that morning, my team was hit by a suicide truck bomb. I was taken to the Fallujah Surgical Hospital. I was treated there. I was able to return to full duty 72 hours later. But a lot of my friends were hurt far worse than I was. My buddy Joel, who was standing about this close to me, my buddy Joel ended up having a severe head injury. Joel ended up being CASVAC'd, casualty evacuated all the way back to the United States. So when I came home, I went to see Joel. I also went to Bethesda to the Naval Hospital to visit with some of our other recently returned wounded Marines. And as any veteran or family member of a veteran will tell you, you walk into one of those hospital rooms and you're often talking to very young men and women. 19, 20, 21 years old. Now, I asked everybody who was there a little bit about their units. I asked them about their deployments. We joked with each other a little bit about our different hometowns and baseball and football rivalries. And then I said to each one of them, I said, tell me, what do you want to do when you recover? And every single one of them said to me, I want to return to my unit. They all said, I want to return to my unit. Now, the harsh reality was for a lot of these men and women is they were not going to be able to return to their unit, certainly not anytime soon. One guy had lost both of his legs, another lost use of his right arm, part of his right lung, another lost a good part of his hearing. And what I had seen working in one of Mother Teresa's homes for the destitute and dying, what I'd seen in Cambodia, what I'd seen doing service work here at home, was that a lot of times the most serious injury for people is not having been burned, it's not having lost a limb, it's not even having lost their eyesight. The most serious injury for people comes when they lose their sense of purpose and they lose their sense of team. And what I also saw was happening was that these men and women who came home, who were still what they had always been, they were warriors, who'd taken on al-Qaeda, who'd volunteered for and accepted the hardest and most dangerous missions, who'd taken an oath to defend all of us. What I saw is that far too many of them were being broken and mistreated by our own government. There are some honorable, heroic, and very hardworking people in the VA. They do everything that they can to help our veterans. But the VA was and is one of the largest and most dysfunctional bureaucracies in the country. What they were saying to my friends as they came home is they would say, sir, if you're 60% disabled, they say, we'll pay you as if you're 100% disabled as long as you don't work. So you think about that. All of the incentives are aligned in the wrong direction. So you get these once proud and productive people who come home and they're put into a system that's almost designed to make them think of themselves as disabled and a burden. The other thing that was happening is that my friends would be hurting. They'd walk into the VA and they'd come out with a prescription for drugs. They'd go back home, they'd be hurting for 3 or 4 more weeks, they'd walk back into the VA and they'd come out with another prescription for drugs. I saw some really capable and courageous people who came home and they ended up addicted to prescription medication. They started drinking at 9 o'clock in the morning. And people who had proudly worn the uniform of the United States of America, some of them, were afraid to look their own kids in the eye, ashamed to do so. So I decided to do something about it. I donated my combat pay from Iraq. 2 friends put in the money from their disability checks. And we used that to start an organization called The Mission Continues. And our belief at the Mission Continues was and is today that every single returning veteran who comes home can find a way to live a life of purpose and productivity and dignity and meaning again here at home. I could tell you thousands of stories about the men and women who we've worked with. I'll tell you just one very quick one. Very first veteran who we worked with here in Missouri was a guy named Tim Smith. Tim was in community college when September 11th happened. He was patriotic. He joined the Army. He went overseas, came back from Iraq after a couple tough deployments. Tim had some physical injuries. Tim also had seen 8 of his friends killed one day. He saw other friends carried off the battlefield, wounded and disabled. And when Tim came home, he found himself waking up every night looking for his rifle underneath his bed, struggling to relate to his wife, to his one young son. So I sat down with Tim and we talked. And look, I believe that if you really care about people and you want to make a difference for them, then you have to be willing to tell them not just what they want to hear. You got to be willing to tell them what they need to hear. I said to Tim, I said, look, man, you still have a tremendous amount to offer to your family and our community and our country, but you also are going to have to make some tough decisions and some better choices. So we put Tim through our program at the Mission Continues. And what we did in our program was we helped our veterans to come back to their hometowns and to start serving again. And they went back to work at Habitat for Humanity, at their local church, at a Big Brothers Big Sister, at a Boys and Girls Club. And as they started to serve other people, they started to rebuild their own sense of purpose. What we also did at the same time was we connected them with other veterans and private sector mentors who could help them to see how they could use their military skill set in the civilian world. I'm really happy to tell you that today, Tim Smith, who could have spent the rest of his life on welfare and disability, instead today, he runs his own business. It's a business right here in Missouri. It's a business called Patriot Commercial Cleaning. It's a commercial cleaning business. Today, Tim has 49 commercial cleaning contracts. He hires other veterans. He's hired 42 other veterans. Now, that work that we started with Tim Smith, as we're gathered here this afternoon, we are now working with over 8,000 veterans in all 50 states. We were successful because we asked people to step forward and to join our mission. Now, I ran the Mission Continues for 7 years. When my son Joshua was born in July of 2014, I made a transition from CEO of the Mission Continues to the board. You will also all remember that it was in August of 2014 that Ferguson happened. Now, in addition to starting the Mission Continues when I came back from Iraq, I'd also started my own business. One of the things that I did in my work was that I worked and trained with law enforcement officers here in Missouri and around the country. I knew some of the guys who were on the St. Louis SWAT team. I went down to Ferguson myself. And I can tell you the great tragedy of Ferguson, the great tragedy of Ferguson, was that if we had had a leader who had shown up with any kind of command presence and courage and calm and clarity, we would have had peace by the second night. But nobody showed up. Our governor failed to show up. Chris Koster, the state's attorney general, chief law enforcement officer, failed to show up. And when they did show up, they made the situation worse. When Chris Koster finally showed up, he got on stage with outside agitators like Al Sharpton and apologized for the police. Our law enforcement officers deserve to have a leader who respects what it means to put on body armor and wear a sidearm. They deserve to have a leader who respects what it means to say goodnight to your family and step into the dark and do dangerous work. And my opponent, who had always talked about his support for law enforcement, as soon as they became unpopular, he dropped them. And you know what? We are all suffering the consequences for that now. And it wasn't just Ferguson. I mean, look at what else has happened. And it's not like I walked home from Ferguson and I decided I was going to run for governor. But I came home and I talked with Sheen. I said, I cannot believe that no one is even willing to go to the front lines and show up. And then you look around our state, it's not just Ferguson. I mean, look at what happened at the University of Missouri. This is our university in the middle of the state. We should be able to be proud of it. And yet what happened? Once again, because we had leaders who weren't willing to go to the front lines, it became a national embarrassment. And in Missouri, unfortunately, it's not just these crises that grab the headlines. When you look over the course of the past decade, Missouri is 47th in economic growth. Now, we just finished a bus tour where we did over 150 town halls and events around the state of Missouri. We met with thousands of people who are out of work. Businesses are leaving Missouri. And people who are lucky enough to have a job often aren't seeing a raise for 6 or 7 years. We have a crisis in education, and it's not just in St. Louis and Kansas City, but we're also failing a lot of our students in our rural school districts. I mentioned to you the work we did at The Mission Continues, helping veterans who came home. We worked with a lot of families who fell on hard times. Some of them found themselves on food stamps, on welfare. Well, you know what we did? We helped them off. We helped them to get quality private sector jobs. We helped them to start and to successfully run their own businesses. They just did a study of all of the 50 states, of our abilities to move people off of welfare to work. And out of all 50 states, Missouri ranks 50th. Look, I know that we can do better. But for us to do better, it's going to take strong conservative leadership from outside of the political establishment. So a couple key things that you need to know about me. Number one, I am pro-life, and I'm always going to defend the lives of the unborn. Number two, I'm always going to stand up for your Second Amendment rights to defend yourselves and your family. Number three, I believe in local control of education, that we need to be supporting our parents and our teachers. And that's why our kids, whether they're in homeschool, private school, or public school, they deserve a chance at a quality education, and that is why we have to fight against Common Core. I also believe that every citizen in Missouri deserves a chance at world-class health care. And that's why, unlike my opponent, I believe that we need to work together to repeal Obamacare. Look, my boxing coach always said to me and to all the guys who he trained, he said, if you want different, do different. The message was, if you want a different result from your life, then you better take different action. And the fact is, if we want a different result from our government, then we're going to have to take action. And that's what we've been doing in this campaign. I've never run for office before. I've never been involved in politics before. But Bob and I were just talking about some of our guys down in Taney County who also have never been involved in politics before. They are stepping up, and they're helping this campaign all over the state. Now, a couple key things that we need to do if we're going to get Missouri right. Number one, we need to clean up Jefferson City. We have a serious problem in Jefferson City, and it needs to be cleaned up. So when I'm governor, we're going to ban all gifts from lobbyists. When I'm governor, we're going to close the revolving door between legislators and special interests. And when I'm governor, we're going to put in place term limits for every statewide office holder. This is, again, one of the big contrasts between me and my opponent. My opponent, who is identified by in a front-page story in the New York Times, is the most corrupt attorney general in the country. Another thing that we're going to do when I'm governor is that we're going to support our police officers. We're going to put in place a public safety agenda to create safer streets and safer neighborhoods. We have a public safety crisis in the state of Missouri. Right? And it's not just in the big cities. But I mean, when you look at St. Louis, St. Louis is now the murder, aggravated assault, rape, and per capita robbery capital of the country. Kansas City and Springfield have rates of violent crime triple the national average. But I suggest you talk to any of your sheriffs, talk to any chief of police, and ask them if it's easier or harder to recruit police officers now. We need to have a governor who's going to stand up for our law enforcement officers. Third thing we got is we have to turn this economy around, folks. Look, I've been on the front lines working with veterans and their families. There is nothing that you can do that has a stronger effect for a family and for communities than to have people have quality jobs. And we need more private sector paychecks and bigger private sector paychecks here in the state of Missouri. And for that to happen, we have to cut back on regulations. We have to sign right-to-work legislation. Again, one of the big differences between me and my opponent. I also think that we have to reform welfare. We have an absolutely broken welfare system in the state of Missouri. And we also have to, and this is just part of where all of you come in, we have to support agriculture. Agriculture is the number one industry here in the state of Missouri. We got over 250,000 people employed in agriculture. We got another 37,000 employed in food processing and storage and transportation. And this is what's so frustrating, is that we actually have a great opportunity in front of us. Over the course of the next generation, we need to double world food production. Well, here in Missouri, with 108,000 family farms, with a unique system of rivers and roadways, as leaders in biotechnology and agricultural technology, we can lead the efforts to feed the world. And you know what? That will not only have a tremendous effect here in the state of Missouri, but I've been overseas. I have worked with hungry people. I've worked with hungry children. And I know how important it is that we do our part to feed the world. Now, there's a tremendous opportunity that's in front of us, but if we want to achieve different results, if we want to have different results than we've seen in the state of Missouri, then it's going to take all of us coming together. A politician would tell you, elect me and I'll fix it. That's not what I'm here to tell you. I'm here to tell you, let's win this campaign together so that we can fix it, so that we can do great things, and so that together we can build a Missouri that we are proud to pass on to our kids and our grandkids. Thank you, guys, and God bless you. We'll take some questions, right? We have some time for some questions.
Yeah. Okay, we've got some folks with mics, and we'll take some questions. Please, when you hold up your hand and I recognize you, give a chance for the mic to get to Ed, get the mic to you. All right, any questions? All right, right here. Here comes Greg, Bob. Wait till you get a mic, and then we'll go.
Yeah, our roads and bridges in the state are getting in very bad condition.
Yes, sir.
What's your plan for the transportation?
Yeah, so it's roads and bridges. I'd also suggest to you, Bob, it's also ports. We also, whenever we think about infrastructure, I think about roads, bridges, ports. I also think about broadband access, which is actually a key piece of our infrastructure moving forward. And you're absolutely right. We've got a real problem here in the state of Missouri. We've got 3,500 structurally deficient bridges. We have to invest in our ports because, as all of you know, we just had the opening of the Panama Canal. What that means is that the price for the shipment of bulk goods is going to lower. With our unique system of rivers and roadways here in Missouri, we have tremendous opportunities for increased agricultural exports to Latin America and to Asia. But what I would tell you is, and again, done 150 town halls and events around the state of Missouri. If you ask the people of Missouri, you pull 100 people in, and you say, how many of you believe that we should be spending more money on roads, bridges, and ports? 95 of them will say yes. You ask those same 100 people, how many of you trust the government of the state of Missouri to spend that money wisely? 95 of them will say no. You've seen repeatedly, time and time again, the people of Missouri stand up and say, we don't trust the government of Missouri to spend more money wisely. Okay. So what you have to do to rebuild that trust is, first, you have to start with the ethics program that I talked about. Second, you need to have a governor who's actually willing to go through the budget and reestablish trust with the people of Missouri. Right now, we got a $27 billion budget in the state of Missouri. And when you look at that budget, there is no way to tell what the government of Missouri produces for the people of Missouri. Now, outside conservative governors have done this in other states. Mitch Daniels did this in Indiana. I'm going to do this as governor. I always, in my business, when I ran The Mission Continues, when I was in the SEAL teams, you insist on results and accountability. The way we get a hold of that budget is that you assign every agency of government a mission. For every line item in the budget, you put in place a performance metric so that you can actually measure what the government is producing. One of the other reasons why people don't trust the government of the state of Missouri is because of all the special interest insider deals. Over $500 million last year in special interest tax credits. Some of those programs might work, some of them not, but the average citizen looks up at those programs and they say, I don't understand them and I know I didn't get one. And they don't trust what's happening there. So we need to create a lot more transparency in government. One of the things I'm going to do as governor, and they did this already in Ohio, so it can be done, we're going to create MissouriCheckbook.gov. Keep in mind, tax money is your money. When Sheena and I write a check, we can go online and we can look at our bank statement, or we can wait till we get a paper statement. When we run our credit card, we can go online and we can look at our credit card statement, or we can wait till we get a paper statement. And then we can see where we actually spent our money. What we're going to do is we're going to create MissouriCheckbook.gov so that you can see where your money goes. We're going to put every check that the government writes online. This is our money, and the people of Missouri need to be able to see it. One of the last things we need to do, Bob, in order to make things increase trust in government is that you need to introduce common sense and clear legislation. Has anybody here ever tried to read the Affordable Care Act? Ask yourself, why is it so complicated? Why do they make it so complicated? One of the reasons why they make it so complicated is because that is where corruption hides. Corruption hides in complication. We need to create that kind of clarity. If you create that kind of clarity and you increase people's trust in government, then I believe that we have a governor who's going to invest in our priorities, we're going to invest in those roads, those bridges, and those ports, and we can make a case to the people of Missouri about why we need to do more.
Another question.
If you're elected governor, who would be your director of ag?
Yeah, it's a great question, Daryl. Right now, what I'm going to do when I think about my team, it's actually the most important team. Look, I know that our current director of agriculture, a lot of folks think very highly of Mr. Fordyce. Right, so I'll certainly consider him. I'd turn to Blake. I'd turn to Dan. I'd turn to my friends like Brian Klippenstein, Jackie Klippenstein, other folks who know really good people, and put them in there. Here's one thing I know for sure, Daryl. I will never, ever, ever understand agriculture in the way that all of you do. I didn't grow up on a farm. I didn't grow up on a ranch. I didn't grow up running an agribusiness. We're going to build a team of people who actually understand agriculture so that they understand how to fight for you and how to work for you. It's also why it's very important to me that we get our Lieutenant Governor Mike Parson elected with me. We need to have a really, really strong team of folks who can have your back, and that's what I'm going to do.
All right, another question. All right, we got one over here, Ron.
Ron Hardigee from Gascanade County. Missouri DNR is kind of the local implementation of EPA policy. What would you do as governor to push back on EPA regulations?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, Ron. Look, we have tremendous federal overreach. And this is, again, one place where I differ from my opponent, right? Whether it's Obamacare, Common Core, EPA waterways of the U.S. regulations, where now they're trying to regulate 99% of all of the acreage here in the state of Missouri, you need to have a governor who's going to push back against that federal overreach. Now, that's an easy thing to say. Let's talk about in a very practical way how you do that. And this is true not just for farmers, ranchers, and agribusinesses, but it's true for all businesses. I was meeting with a guy actually who's in oil and gas near Kansas City. He said to me, when I have to meet with the EPA in Texas or Louisiana, when the EPA comes in, he said, my state officials are at that same meeting on my side of the table. He said, when I have to do that in Missouri, I'm alone. So what we need to do is we need to have a governor who's going to work with our state officials to make sure, because as you know, what happens a lot of times is the EPA and the federal government, what they really like to do is to bully people. They'll come in, they'll find an individual farmer or rancher, right? They'll threaten them with lawsuits, threaten them with fines, and they'll push them around. We need to have a governor who's going to make sure that state officials and the state government have the backs of and are actually present at those meetings to support our farmers, our ranchers, our agribusinesses here in the state. And to be clear, I'm going to do that not just with the EPA, but with all of this federal overreach, right? People who are dealing with the VA, yes, it's a federal bureaucracy, but we're going to have a governor who's going to have the backs of our veterans and veterans' families so that we can make sure that we're protecting the people of Missouri.
All right, Bill, can we get a microphone here?
Congratulations on your victory, and
thank you, sir,
for coming.
Yes, sir.
But I probably want to ask a question that's a little difficult.
Go for it.
What really concerns me is the amount of money that I see that's come to your campaign from the East and West Coast,
yeah.
And that really is a concern of mine.
Yeah, Bill, first of all, I'm very, very glad that you asked the question. I mean, just first of all, I outraised my opponents in Missouri. As you know, you look at the fourth quarter of 2015, the first quarter of 2016, we raised more money in the state of Missouri than my opponents. I ran a national organization called The Mission Continues. We work with veterans and veterans' families. We're now working with over 8,000 veterans and their families in all 50 states. Running a national organization, I got to meet people all over the country. Strong conservatives who, when they knew that I was running for governor, they said, this is a kind of guy who we need to get behind. And they also came in to support our campaign. And I'd also ask you to contrast that, people who got to know me as a leader supporting veterans, with my opponent, whose money comes from unions and trial lawyers.
Just to follow up on that real fast, in the form that we received here, it said that you, when asked about campaign finance, that you wanted to hold yourself to a higher standard. Here in Missouri, we allow unlimited campaign donations, but we require very strict disclosure. It's my understanding that I might be wrong on this, but your campaign received the largest donation in Missouri campaign history. But you received it from a super PAC that does not have to disclose their donors. if you're going to hold yourself to a higher standard, would you call on that super PAC to disclose their donors?
Yeah, sure. And what was your name, sir?
Justin.
Justin, yeah. Justin, the organization you're referring to is called Seals for Truth. And I don't know how closely you had a chance to watch the campaign, but one of the things that you probably saw during the campaign was one of my opponents at the very beginning of the campaign put out an anonymous ad full of lies about my military record. And then they lied for months about their responsibility for it. When they were finally confronted about their lies, they had nothing to say. And I have had SEALs around this country who stepped forward to support me. And that's what you saw with Seals for Truth. We've been campaigning on this bus tour with a guy named Kaj Larson, who was with me at the victory party on Tuesday night, a guy who went through every single day of training with me. They were disgusted by these lies against my military record. We had Rob O'Neill come in to join the campaign. Rob O'Neill is an American hero, SEAL Team 6 operator, one of the most decorated special operations warriors of our time. This is the guy who shot and killed Osama bin Laden. And he said these attacks against Eric are sick, false, and cowardly. I come from a world where when people say that they're going to have your back, they have your back. And the SEALs got together, and SEALs and Naval Special Warfare, also SWCC, Special Warfare Combatant Craft Crewmen, they got together and they said, we're gonna support Eric. And I've never done this before. My understanding is that they followed all of the MEC and FEC guidelines with their investment. And I'm honored to have my fellow SEALs standing behind me.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes for you to close up, and so we would ask you to make any closing statements you'd like to make.
Yeah, Blake, I don't think I'll even need 3 minutes. I just want to tell all of you, I very much appreciate you having me here. Appreciate what you do, and I very much look forward to working with you. We have a tremendous opportunity here in Missouri. And I think that the great tragedy of what's happened is that when you look around Missouri, we have fantastic leaders. We've got fantastic, strong, moral, clear leadership. We have it in our business community. We have it in agriculture. We have it in our hospitals. We have it in our university system. We have it in athletics organizations. We have it in our churches and our synagogues. The one place where we haven't had that kind of strong leadership is in government. And again, I believe that together there's a tremendous amount that we can do. I believe that we have a fantastic opportunity that's before us, and I look forward to working with all of you to seize it. Because if we do this right, folks, if we do this right, we can, all of us, build a Missouri that we are really proud of, and really proud to pass on to our kids and our grandkids. And I'd be honored to work with you and honored to have your support. Thank you guys very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Greitens. Appreciate you being here, spending time with us.